The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hi, you're listening to Agile Uprising. This is Jutta Eckstein and John Buck. My name is Jutta, and I'm in the Agile world forever, it seems. So I started in 97 and started also with the Agile in the Large in 2002 already. So just, you know, so I'm around for a long time in that field.
And I'm John Buck, the co-author of Company-Wide Agility with Beyond Budgeting, Open Space, and Sociocracy. And I started down the path many, many years ago when I was just out of college and it occurred to me I couldn't vote for my boss. And even though I was had a job I was happy with and I would vote for my boss, I couldn't vote for my boss. So I started looking for, was there anybody I could work for where I could vote for my boss? And I ended up finding something called Sociocracy in Holland and became quite an expert in it, used it as a manager, and then started saying there's more to it than that. And about that point, I met Jutta, and we decided that we would give a presentation together on Agile and Sociocracy, and then decided that wasn't enough, and that's how we ended up writing the book.
All right. Well, thank you, Jutta, and thank you, John. As listeners, if you can't tell, this is another episode of the Agile Uprising podcast. You're stuck with your favorite, unfavorite host again, Jay Hursko. And the topic of this week's episode is Bossa Nova, which is, like Jutta and John said, company-wide agility with Beyond Budgeting, Open Space, and Sociocracy. To give a little bit of a lead in, I came across this book through another book, which someone else who we just interviewed, Jorgen Hesselberg, and his Unlocking Agility. And he, the way the book is set up, he threw it as almost things that you might want to look into. And when I read through that note, I went, well, this sounds pretty interesting. And I picked up the book, and truth be told, my mind was blown away. We just finished up our series on frameworks. And while this is not a framework, this is a very novel approach to combining different ideas that are out there in the ecosystem into a way to actually get some true transformational agility, which I'm not going to bury the lead. I'm going to let you two talk about it. So, John, you sort of touched on it a bit. How did you two meet, become connected? Was it we kept running into each other at the same circles thing? Or even Jutta, how did you guys come together to say, okay, this is something we want to do?
Okay, so the thing was, I got introduced to Sociocracy by a student of John, and this was, I don't remember, probably in 2014 or something, or 12, I don't remember. However, and I'm actually also chairing one of the largest conferences in Germany, and so I ran into Sociocracy in November, and the conference that I chaired was in January. Now, one of my keynote speakers dropped out. So he got sick. And so I thought, oh, I just learned about that Sociocracy. So I looked for a keynote speaker. And at first I found, because the conference is in Germany, I found Peter van der Meschi, who is in the Netherlands, which is closer than the States, right? And so I invited him. And then Peter and I went actually to several of the actual conferences. So I kind of tracked him along and said, well, you really should share that. And so we put this together, and we're always talking about Agile and Sociocracy. And then we also submitted to the Big Agile conference. And now John probably knows better when that was.
Atlanta.
Atlanta, whenever, whichever year that was. And we got accepted. But then Peter said, well, now the US is too far for me. Let me introduce you to my colleague, John. And so, yeah, probably you pick it up from there, John.
Well, and so we talked about how you should look at combining Sociocracy and Agile. And then I remember having coffee right after that session. And we were kind of saying, you know, that's not really all of it. It's like, that sounded good, but it, you know, it's not, there's more to it. And so then we said, well, all right, why don't we write a book about that? And that was done. That was like, you know, a big decision made, snap judgment right over that coffee. And There we go. That's how the book came into being.
That's usually how most life-changing events happen, right? In a snap reaction, no, right. Not overthought, right? So one of my questions was where the genesis came from, so that you both did a wonderful job transitioning to me quite easily. So in the book, and I'm going to put a link to purchase in the show notes. Very early on in the book, you talk about some problem statements. And for those of you following along at home with a copy, it's actually page 14. And your problem statements, and I'll rattle them off for those that don't have
them. Oh, that's really a great marketing case. Right? It means everyone needs to buy the book. I love that.
Well, they do need to buy the book, but that's
how much are we paying you for this?
Hey, okay, I would be totally happy with just a retweet. Believe it or not, those are the hardest things to get. So the problem statements you both talk about is, the first one is existing concepts cannot be directly applied to company strategy, structure, or process in the VUCA world. VUCA is obviously volatility, uncertainty, complexity, ambiguity. The second statement is companies make decisions from the top down, but often people at lower levels who are closer to the realities of the product or market have valuable insights that are currently ignored. Number three is there is a collision of values underlying shareholder interest in short-term profits and a focus on the needs of the customers. And number four is for a company to be agile, all departments must be agile. However, existing agile systems struggle when applied to non-engineering departments. When I read this, the light bulb went off in my head because this is basically every transformation struggle I've been through in a nutshell. I'd like to talk a little bit about how you actually were able to distill these down into four succinct statements, because for those of us that are going through transformations, those of us that are years deep in transformations, some of these may resonate really, really heavily. And I think, Yuta, I'll start with you. So how did you and John start working towards getting the funnel down to say, okay, these are the four things we universally recognize as problematic?
Well, the thing was more that we kind of explored what's happening with our clients. So I know, so from my point of view, being in the agile world, and as I started with my introduction, starting with in the large, so scaling agile way back when, so nobody was interested at that in 2002, right? And anyway, and then also distributed agile, and with distributed and large, what typically happens sooner or later that almost the rest of the company, if not then a big part of it, becomes part of the success or failure of it. Because the more people are involved and the more sites are involved, it just spreads all over the place. So the need that the company really is also at least providing an agile environment was really there. And some of the companies, they kind of started, okay, we see this is working there. What are you actually doing there? Can we copy it over to what we are doing over there? So in marketing and sales. And that's kind of how it started, at least for me, that I helped there at first implementing just plain agile. Yet very soon I realized that's not a great fit. But then also I figured, well, there are others who have found out stuff already, so we are not the first ones. However, we are probably, so we in quotes means the agile world, agile community here. We have been way more successful, I think, at least marketing-wise, and so that people are talking about it and hopefully also using it, than a lot of these others who have been also successful, but nobody really talked about it. So the thing was, we came to these four things really mainly from what we saw is happening with our clients. And then, of course, also what we are hearing in the exchange from colleagues at conferences and so on. Yeah.
So from my standpoint, you know, like I said, I started out looking for how can I vote for my boss? How can we have organizational democracy? And the where I was focusing was on the fact that the top-down hierarchical structure couldn't really receive feedback. If you go out and make comments in the suggestion box, or the boss does management by walking around or whatever, the feedback that they get can be ignored. Just to the point where they really need to have their noses rubbed in the feedback, they say, well, you know, I'm making the decision. And so the lack of ability to have everybody really operate as one, not just a bunch of servants, private servants as opposed to public servants and so on, particularly in an atmosphere that's more and more complex, So you need everybody thinking together. That was really obvious to me and something that, that sociocracy tries to address. But I was also noticing that as I dealt with Agile or companies using Agile, there was this, there was a lack of the people doing Agile being able to say, hey, you know, top of company, you need to listen to us. But also there was a lack of understanding of the collision of values. Like if in the Agile manifesto values, you're focusing on the customer and the customer comes first, and a product owner can be doing their very best to serve the customer. And the company says, hey, we have a quarterly profit. We've got a report. No, we're not going to make a five-year investment. No, we're not going to do this. And so there was a big collision of values. How do you serve the customer and make a profit? No way of getting other perspectives into the core of the control of the company. And so, those are, with what you just said and with what I said, really constituted the four things that we identified based on our experience with clients.
Okay. So, again, the title of the book is Bossa Nova, and some of the methods or ways of working that you combine is along with Agile as ideally the bounding box, the principles of practices. You tie in open space, beyond budgeting, and sociocracy. Now, we've talked a little bit about sociocracy, and we've actually done an episode about that previously. Can either one of you explain how open space and beyond budgeting fit into this? Well, it sounds like the genesis of this idea was Agile with sociocracy brought in. Where did beyond budgeting open space come from? How did that become part of this recipe? I guess is my question.
Yuta, why don't you start with beyond budgeting?
Okay. Yeah, so beyond budgeting actually entered the Agile world also not too late. So I guess something around 2008 or 2009, we had Beate Bogner speaking at the XP conference. And that really was an eye-opener for me because, well, on the one hand, beyond budgeting sounds like it's finance only. And on the one hand, yeah, maybe it is, but finance is just ruling the world. And the way you're dealing with finance in your company is also the way you are managing the company. So it's directly related, and therefore beyond budgeting is more than looking at the money only, just because it has such a big effect. And when Beate first there spoke about what they are doing with beyond budgeting, and actually the really cool thing about that is also that it's something that emerged or has been discovered by CFOs, because they found that some companies doing something in a better way than they're used to. So this is different than, for example, Agile, which is more invented by coaches, consultants. And so this is really from the field it emerged. And what they figured was the way we are dealing with budgets, mainly if we look at annual budgeting and fixing this, it always leads actually to a negative result for the company. So either, let's say I'm applying for money for my project and the market changes and I don't need all that money. I've never seen that somebody gives it back.
Nobody gets promoted cutting the check. Nobody gets promoted giving the money back. Right. Exactly.
And therefore what's happening? Well, I will spend it, because if I would give it back, I know for sure that the next time I ask for money for a project, I will only get like half of it, because everyone said, well, we know already if Yuta is asking for that, she's always asking for too much. And so the money is gone, which is not a positive thing for the company. Now, if it's the other way around, so I got my money and the market has changed and I would need way more in order to be really ahead of the competition. Well, the money has been distributed already and there isn't really something left. And I know there are companies who have like a buffer or something, yet it's more like pretending to be under control of what's going on than really being adaptive to what's going on in the market. And so having this fixed budgets is really something that also means we are setting all our goals in advance and we control against them, and we kind of limit ourselves in being responsive, adaptive, well, agile maybe. So it's really from this financial point of view, and it's a big one. And again, we means the agile community, we in the agile world have ignored that for quite some time. And then we maybe thought, okay, we have to invent something ourselves, yet the stuff is out there. So
Repurpose it instead of creating it a whole cloth. Yeah.
Yes.
And the, as you just said, beyond budgeting is about how you're managing the company. And so that goes over into the personnel world too, for instance, and the way you set targets and the way you reinforce things causes a lot of distortion. For example, if I'm in the sales department and I'm supposed to sell 100 units by the end of December and I'm only at 60, then if it's like the beginning of November, I'm thinking, I'm not going to make 100. So rather than cause this trouble again next year, I'm going to defer some of these orders and get them in January. And then I'll have, you know, like a really great sales year next year. What happens if that 100 really is a lousy goal, because like maybe my competition's selling 400 of the same kind of thing, or maybe my competition's selling 50. Well, that's a good or a bad goal that makes sense in the market, not just within some target somebody set within the company. There's lots more things like, how do you actually go about giving people a bonus? Is it really something relevant to the market as it is right now, or something that was set a year ago as a target? And you know, do you have people not really responding to the market because their performance objectives were set like at a time when it's not relevant to the market now?
Well, and in an absolute manner and not relative.
Yeah. The one liner, but, and I eventually do want to line up the art to have them on, because I've actually just picked up the book. I started to dig through it. The one part of that, of the first, and it's early on in the Beyond Budgeting section, you talk about how the three things a budget is used, and John, you just, and both you and Utah went to it. It's a budget is used for a target. It's used for a forecast, and it's used for capacity. Right. Planning, which are three things that really should not be combined, because like you just said, they're point in time. And I dropped that line at PI Planning to somebody from our value management department. And I said, why do we use these budgets? And I said, well, we try to use them for these three things. Does that really make sense? And I walked away, and I think the guy's head is still spinning. He may still be up in Connecticut with his head still spinning. But it does make you think, right? And that whole section is, well, what are we really using? Like you said, nobody gets promoted giving money back or taking more than they need. And it's almost irrational. Right, we're talking about reacting to change in a quick fashion, and yet here we are setting a target 18 months out, committing ourselves to, you know, feast or famine. It's a little nuts.
But you still get a nice warm feeling of being in control. That's the important thing.
Yes, the false sense of control. It's the watermelon, right? It's green on the outside, it's red on the inside. It's like project status. And I think, John, to the next topic, you were going to talk a little bit about open space and how that comes into this whole equation.
Sure. The criteria that we used for do we include this methodology in our accommodation or not was that companies had to be relying on it to do the method. And everybody's familiar probably with a conference open space. I'm assuming, you know, where you get together and there's like this small structure of people saying, I want to talk about this topic, and they go talk about it and they can float around, and they Owen says, you know, it's like it's all day long break time. And that allows people's passions to emerge and people to really start thinking creatively. You can also use what I call organization open space, where, you know, if it's today, I think I have a new project, and I get a couple of people lined up, then okay, you've suddenly got a new assignment. Passion bounded by responsibility is very effective in producing really creative companies. And so we said, all right, we've got to throw this into the mix also.
So it is really, on the one hand, still you can use what you're now called conference open space, like using open space as a facilitation technique, as it's used in open space agility. So you use this for a change transformation or anything, that's absolutely fine. But what we really have more in mind here, that the whole company has the space open at all times. So everyone is invited at all time to come up with a cool idea, a new product, a new feature. And if there are enough people who are interested in that, it will happen. So it's not waiting for the next design thinking session or the next think tank on whatever. It is whenever an idea pops up, it's like this big open space that's running the whole time, and you just put it up, and if there are people who go along, then it's a go. And there are companies, actually, this is also a thing that we looked at when we said what makes sense to put together. There are companies who use this as their strategy. So everything that we put together here is not new. So Beyond Budgeting exists for a long time. Open Space also in that way exists for really a while. And Sociocracy definitely as well. And we just kind of the synthesis of it, because they all have a different angle on what's happening in the company, is the new thing, really. So everything is proven, and that's a good thing, because you are not jumping into something that, well, I don't know what it is.
And yeah, you're not forcing someone to learn some new sort of nomenclature.
Yes.
And, you know, here's a certification track, you know, right. All that sort of stuff. The open space idea for me is really fascinating, because, and even we talked about it before we started recording, Daniel Mezick, when I interviewed him and we talked about it, I thought about the most recent transformation I was part of, where in a large organization, you don't know what you've got. Like when you have exponentially amount of people, somebody, you know, John may be in a cube somewhere in some remote location, and the, you know, if you want to get into, you know, Bitcoin or whatever, you know, like that sort of thing, maybe John is a guru, and we just don't know. The idea of an open space where, hey, it's open, show up, and when you come to transformations, there are probably agilists or agile practitioners floating around the org you don't even know you have. That if they show up and they say, hey, I'm ready, and I understand this and I understand that, well, you're a step ahead of, okay, well, now we need coaches, and let's engage the vendor, and that whole song and dance, again, ties back to the budgeting piece.
Yeah, well, maybe there's one thing. So it ties back to the budgeting piece. It also ties back into HR, where Beyond Budgeting is also very strong. And it ties back to that, because it's really getting rid of using job descriptions as like boxes where we put people in, but more using, it's maybe a phrase, but still using the innovative power of everyone who's there and thinking outside that job description. Exactly the example you gave, right? So somebody might have an idea and an understanding or an experience in something nobody knew. And using that potential is what organizational open space brings.
And even beyond that, you might have the solution, two or three people who get a chance to get together, and suddenly the three of them together have a new idea.
Right. Increases that organizational serendipity, where you just have a couple people who just happen to end up in the same orbit. It's really, really powerful stuff to think about. You don't know what you got until you start using it. So, next question I have is, early on in the book, you actually, it's not even a question, more of a statement, you distill everything you're working on down into four values.
Could before we go there?
Sure.
Your thought was also, I think, in how do these combine? And it says combination, but it's if you talk about sodium chloride methodology, you're better off calling it salt, because it's like it becomes something different. And Yuta and I, as we wrote, began to get the feeling that when these were all together, there was a fluidness to it, almost like some kind of dance improvisation thing that seems to characterize what happens when all these start to come together. And so the term bossa nova is like a, you know, it's a chant, so isn't that cute? But it is an attempt to call it salt as opposed to sodium chloride. And how they all come together is we're still like kind of watching. It's like, what does this new compound, it's as opposed to a combination, look like?
And to be completely honest, one of the things that caught my eye was the term bossa nova, right? Isn't that that's a Latin dance, right? And then you explain in the book that it, and if you think about our transformations and what we do, it is a bit of a dance. It is a bit of, like you said, improvisation, wait and see, you know, someone takes the lead and you follow, then the other person takes the lead. So it is a, it's a, I don't think it's an attempt to be cute, John. It worked, it's stuck in my head.
and interestingly enough, if you have a live band and people dancing, the people affect the music as well as the music affecting the people. It's like a really fluid, something else happens.
Right.
And so the that's what we were trying to capture.
Perfect. Perfect. So regarding your values, everything gets distilled down into, you summarize it with four values, the values of self-organization, transparency, constant customer focus, and continuous learning. So can you give us a little bit of insight into what those four things mean to you and how they relate to the idea of Bossa Nova as a whole?
Well, one thing was we were looking, coming from the problem statement, so which you, where you started also with this podcast. So what's really needed for companies? And actually we felt like not only ask companies for that, but also those problem statements do, they ask for companies to be agile really. And agile in the more literal sense, not agile in like every company needs to be a scrum company or whatever, but agile being responsive, adaptive, flexible, nimble, all of that. And in order to do so, we also looked at, okay, what if we use agile as the kind of the foundation, what do we know about agile? And well, of course, there's the manifesto, and we have always this discussion, does it really fit for whatever hardware, marketing, budgeting companies, and so on. And there are a lot of people inventing new manifestos, and we on purpose said we don't want to invent anything new or suggest an update or whatever, but we want to use what's there and just provide a translation so the same values that are in the manifesto fit to company-wide agility. And so if you look at the values as they are stated in the manifesto, they really transfer directly to those four values, like individuals and interactions over processes and tools, leads directly into self-organization, because that's the thing that is really holding or well, maybe holding that space, I wanted to say, but actually it's more driving the whole value creation. So that's where everything is happening more or less, right? And so on. So if you go through these four values, you end up with the four values we provide. If you translate them so that they are not having this software IT touch anymore, mm-hmm. but they are still the same thing. You know, the one where we probably have the most conversations or had the most conversations in the beginning was transparency. Yet, if you think about it, it's I would say it's also very obvious because it goes back to working software over comprehensive documentation. And the reason for that value is that, not that documentation is bad, but documentation can't just say anything, whereas the working software tells us the truth. So it's making where we are at transparent. It gives us that transparency. And so this is where this comes from. So it still goes back to exactly that statement, right? So this is where we came from by saying, okay, if what's really required is company-wide agility, then let's again look at what's there and try how to make this work in that other environment, which is now the whole company and not software only.
When we were writing this, we actually prepared some tables where we said, gee, if beyond budgeting, we're describing what agile, open space, and sociocracy were doing it with its 12 principles, what would it say? It could describe all those from its framework, or sociocracy could describe the other three from its framework. And we said, the framework we want to use is agile because it's the one that's been the most talked about and people recognize. And so we created a table with the four values and then the four methodologies and put down what open space would say about, you know, the software over documentation. And so we had this big table, and then we condensed what each was saying about the agile principle into a statement that combined all of those thoughts.
But actually, we went even further. So because you kind of were already ahead where we had these four streams. Before, we had like 20, 25 different methods, and we looked at how do they support these values. Yep. And then we figured, oh, they don't do such a good job, or they only slightly touch here or there, or they are too specific, or they are too generic. So kind of Goldilocks approach there.
By the way, I must thank you for that table of all the things you did look at. You greatly exploded my Amazon cart of things I need to read. Every time I have our guests on, I really should thank them, because there were so many things that I got a lot of value in what you used, but I also got a lot of value in what you didn't use, because you explained why. And it made me think, okay, well, human systems dynamics is a term I'd never come across. Maybe I'm ignorant, maybe I'm under a rock. But that sent me down this whole rabbit hole on the internet of, okay, well, explain this to me. And really, so I digress, but thank you. Because again, for our listeners, one of the great things about a lot of these agile books, and I think I talk about this frequently, is there's a lot of reference material in there that you can just pick up one and you'll end up with seven more. And that this is one of those books where, oh, here we go. The wife hates me because I'm in Amazon's big boss's co-op.
Which is actually also a struggle that we still face, and we face it a lot while writing, because also our early readers, they said, well, this is overwhelming. And so we on the one hand, we're also cutting down and also try to write it in a way by saying, okay, this is there, but you don't need to understand this. If you want to explore more, go there. That's good. Yet there's no need in moving forward with the bossa nova, because that was kind of the early feedback that people said, well, okay, and now I need also to learn about HSD and about whatever, you know, Kenefin, and well, in the actual world, people would know about Kenefin, but still, you know, like this and that and everything. And we said, no, you don't need to, but you might want to. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We were more trying to create a framework where you could toss in your own dash of pepper. You know, the
right, and that was, excuse me, again, we just finished up our series on scaling frameworks, and we're going to do a regroup episode where we have a bunch of listeners come on and tell us what they think. But one of the observances that a lot of people have made is a lot of these things come off as very prescriptive, very much a you need to do A, then B, then C. Whereas when you look at, like you said, with Bossa Nova, you're applying all these different ways of working, ways of thinking that are very open-ended and open-minded, in the sense that you can pick and choose the pieces that you need that make the most sense. I brought up the idea of sociocracy in my current transformation, and everybody looked at me like I was on fire, right? Like, oh, it's totally challenging the typical operating paradigm. But the one thing, just as an aside, the one thing from sociocracy I took away that actually was successful is I presented the idea of consensus versus consent.
Yeah.
And we all have those meetings where you walk in with a lot of very highly paid, important people, and they all can't agree. So we were in a planning session talking about a maturity model, and it was the Sharks and the Jets were going back and forth. And I made the remark like, hey, well, do you consent to us taking this? I'm not saying consensus. Do you consent? Do you have anything that in your being, in the fiber of your being, presents you from saying, yes, let's try this? And when I pitched it like that, a couple of people said, no, I guess we can go through with it. And then you can see, again, I'm no sage or brilliant mind, but you can see how people were starting to rattle on their head. Well, I really don't have anything that I can put a stake in the ground and say, I can't do this. So, and that ties to the whole idea of experimentation. Well, just go and see. And if it doesn't work, you change it.
Yeah.
So,
if I could add to that, just last night I was helping a bunch of professors from many different places around the world make some decisions about forming a professional association. And if you've ever had 20 professors in a room together, you will not get agreement. But I was able to explain to them, you know, that like the quick thing about consent is, can you live with it? Is it good enough for now, safe enough to try? And then I had the facilitator go around and ask, you know, do you have any paramount objection, or do you consent to this proposal we had? And we got to one guy, and he was like, I said, I don't know if I do or not. And he was saying something. And when he was finished, I said to the facilitator, that's an objection. And then we went on, and then somebody just interrupted and they said, why was that an objection? And I said, because his body was wiggling the whole time he was talking. He was obviously not comfortable with this. And so that's an objection. And everybody went, oh, and then we went back to him and, you know, we poked into it and it turned out he had a very good point. He just wasn't articulating it very well, but his gut was that it wasn't right. Mm-hmm. And so it's very much not about being logical. It's about kind of getting down to that old lizard that's in the middle of your brain to yep. where the decisions is actually made. And that lizard is not very articulate often.
right. It's the fight, flight, or freeze response, right? When that kicks in, unpack that and figure out why Yuta's in her chair and she's all freaked out. What's the motivator
what's going
there?
On? Yeah, right.
That'll get your answer. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a very non-rational thing. That's where we make decisions.
Right. One of the things in the book that I thought was really, really impressive and I spent a lot of time mulling it around was you have a synthesis of perspectives. And it's another word I never heard before, an organigram, which I thought was, I'm like, oh, look at this one.
You're just not European enough.
Yes. But I am adding color, C-O-L-O-U-R. I'm trying to be equal opportunity here. But the way, and I'll include a picture when I do the write-up, the way you explain how a team sits in an organization and the channels in and out, back and forth, the two-way communication in regards to, on the periphery, you have the artistic piece, then you have the customer, you have the board, you have the support and service teams, and then the interactions through the CEO, the product owner. I thought that was really powerful because it really does help set the stage to a new team, to a new organization, to on this journey. Like, this is where your pieces sit in relation to the grander whole, and these are the open lines of communication you need in order to truly be successful. It can't be a one-way street where we're just dictating to the customer, well, here you go. Here's what you got. And more importantly, the one that opened my eyes was the whole CEO leadership aspect, where it needs to be a two-way street where, yes, they can tell you what you have to do, but you should be able to tell them, here's what we're seeing and what's going on. Like that, like we talked about earlier, the disassociation between what's going on in the lower levels versus what's happening above, where they're, you know, no offense to the sea level, but they're in the tower. They don't necessarily see, you know, us Morlocks down in the trenches keeping the lights on. Can you explain a little bit more about how that whole layout, that whole synthesis of perspectives came to be?
Yuta, would you talk about cross-functional teams, because you really introduced me to the importance of that. And that's at the middle of the diagram.
Yes, yeah, I know. I just wonder, because that's a thing that's probably the best known in the actual world, and because it's actual uprising, that's why I kind of was hesitant. So in the actual world, we always talk about cross-functional teams and how important it is to have that. However, in the context of Bossa Nova, it goes further than what at least I often see in the software world, where when we talk about cross-functional teams, it more or less means back-end and front-end and testers together in a team. And we mean now real cross-functionality across the whole organization, or more or less looking at what is the thing that really creates the value and having this as a value center together in a cross-functional way. So that's at the core of the whole thing. And Chun, why don't you go ahead and first?
Sure. Kind of- sure. So given that you've got one of these cross-functional teams that's not just within the software team, but, you know, it's maybe got somebody from budget or personnel sitting on it, and maybe it's got somebody that worries about how you keep the building clean, whatever seems relevant. And when you create a team like that, that's a value center, it suddenly has four bosses. It's got the traditional people that drive from the shareholders, like CEOs in the C-suite. It's got the customer, because you're trying to please the customer. It's got those people that represent all those structural environmental restrictions, like you can't make these things and then dump them in the creek, or you need to pay attention to this regulation. And it also is a boss that's sort of unseen, which is that which is inspiring you, the value system. And all of these bosses can be autocratic bosses. And by that, for example, let's look at your value system. I remember talking with a young woman one time who was running a cafe. And the cafe was marginally successful, but what she said inspired her is that she just loved to deliver beautiful food on a plate. That was the whole value that she was responding to. And it didn't matter whether the customers liked it or not, the food looked beautiful. And so she was being driven by an autocratic boss, which was this concept of beautiful food on the plate. And she was not really able to question that and develop that value. And the business was suffering. So all these are things that need a feedback loop going back to them, and including back to your customer saying you're out to lunch, customer, and they all come together almost like in some kind of cauldron, and so recognizing that I think is really important for that cross-functional team, knowing that it has four bosses at least that it's dealing with, and it needs to be giving feedback to those bosses. And so that just sort of emerged as we were writing the book, that this bossa nova salt stuff had this characteristic to it.
And I think the important thing is to understand that there's a balance, and the balance is needed. At least very often when I have this discussion about the synthesis of perspective, people are asking me, why is the customer not in the center? It should be, because you have constantly the focus on the customer, but now we have the value creation in the center. And the thing is, it might be the case that the customer or the market is asking for something that would lead us to be bankrupt. We cannot do it financially. And so then it's kind of the side of the board, shareholders is equally important, or is the counterpart to it. Or at other times it's more like, the customer is asking for something, but it contradicts our values, maybe our ethical values, maybe, well, my favorite example was always, what about if they're corrupt or putting the money to the Caymans or whatever, and well, maybe this is fine for some companies, but not for others. So the customer is not the one ruling everything. And all the market. It just has a say as these three other bosses, in quotes, as well. So the question is to find the balance and still focus on the value creation.
Okay. So my final discussion point is, we've introduced all these ideas and we now have the bossa nova salt, right? How do we go about introducing this into an organization? What are some of the tips, tricks, hints you would give to say, okay, I've got all these ideas and I think we can really use this. What's the best way to get started? What have you seen work? What have you seen not work? I know a lot of people like to walk in with the manifesto on a giant hammer and swing that around. That doesn't really work for anybody. What are your observances? How do I start getting the bossa nova ground below me?
Well, the key to all is what we call probing. So it is coming up with, what's the situation you are in? What's the hypothesis you are having? If you would make this and that change, what would happen then? And then first you measure your current status in order to find out, is it really true what you assume is true? And then run one or several experiments and do a post-measure. And so this whole thing is what we call a probe. And so some people refer to this as also experimentation, or it's in the notion of fail fast, which I actually hate from the terminology. I think what's needed is a learn fast. And so this is where this whole probing concept is embedded. So what we have in the book as well is, I don't know, I think like 23 probes. What we know from companies, what they tried and that what's helped them in their situation. And the idea is, well, on the one hand, that you might use this right away, yet more so probably you get inspired to come up with your own probe, right? And so look at what's needed in your context to make the next step. Maybe it is, if you go in the direction of the combination of beyond budgeting and open space, a simple first step would be self-selecting teams. You know, it can start really small, and the small starts, and once you are in this probing thing, you always try then the next thing, and the next, and the next, and you see where it's going.
John, any thoughts?
Yeah, I tried an experiment the other day in a presentation I was doing. I had 20 minutes, but I decided that I needed to have some audience participation. And I said, let's talk about complexity. What we're saying in the Bossa Nova book is that when you're dealing with complexity is you hurry up and shut up and sit down and do nothing. and you think for a little bit. This is, some people call them retrospectives, but this is like, you know, the essence of it. And you think, okay, what is going on? Let me leverage the complexity by just looking at it with wonder, as opposed to I've got to control that complexity or it's overwhelming me, and form a hypothesis or a probe about what's going on and develop an experiment and then publish it. And I said, let's make this really practical. I said, you have 30 seconds to think of a complex situation you're facing. Don't make it big. I said, maybe I haven't made any plans for this evening. And so I don't know what's going on. Or maybe my kid just walked home last night with a bad score on her math test because even though she'd studied for it, what's going on? And I said, you got 30 seconds. And everybody got real quiet for a minute. And then I said, now you have another 30 seconds to just wonder about that situation. Be curious about it. And then I said, discuss it with your neighbor. And you have 20 seconds to do that. You each have 20 seconds to just say what it was. And I said, that's basically what you're doing with, you're trying to use it in a company. You're going, huh, look at this. The sales are starting to go down or sales are starting to go up. What's going on? And you think, all right, we know all this theory from the Bossa Nova. What's really relevant out of that? Let's probe and see if that's going on. And just do a conscious experiment. And that's kind of how it works. I had never done that experiment before. Later on, in the session, I said, after we talked about experiments, I said, think about the experiment you're going to do to find the pattern in your situation. And I checked with several people in the audience after the speech, you know, in the lobby afterwards, and they all had come up with something in 30 seconds. And some of them were deeply personal, and I didn't even want to share them. And it was like, everybody was like, oh, wow, well, that was really important that we did that. And so it's like, okay, that's what we're talking about the value river.
It's awesome. So we're quickly approaching time, but I do want to give both of you a chance to share any upcoming speaking events or conferences you're attending. Also, where listeners can find you if they want to learn more. And Yuta, I'll start with you. Anything coming up? Where can listeners find you?
Okay, that's you know, take me by chance. So definitely, I will be, or we both will be, at the Big Agile Conference in Washington, D.C. So that's August 5 and 9. And we have two sessions there on Bossa Nova. One is actually focusing on performance appraisals. So how do you do these, well, some say like performance evaluations? How do you do them in an agile friendly way? So that might be interesting for some people. And another thing that I'm seeing is a meetup for coaching agile journeys. That's August 13th. And I don't know. Well, I have a few more coming up.
Where can we find you, Yuta? Yes, if someone wants to find you, where do they go?
Yes, that's a very good question. So we have a website which is called agilebossanova.org. And there we have also all our dates published where people find out more what we are doing. So if you just check this out and go to the Meet Us, and then you find everything.
And I have a shameless commercial here. We this fall are planning to do some online courses a multi-session training about Bossa Nova. And we are looking for right now for people who are interested. So if you are interested, then look us up. We're on Twitter. I'm John.
Well, on the agilebossanova.org website, there it will be announced.
There it'll be announced there also. But I'm saying, if you're interested in that already, let us know. because we're trying to make sure that we're relevant to the audience. And that came out of us eating our own dog food. We had a little retrospective on all this, and we came up with the decision that we needed to do that. So we're looking forward to it happening in the fall.
Great. Great. So on behalf of Utah and John and myself, I'd like to thank all of our listeners. On behalf of the Agile Uprising, Utah and John, I want to thank you for taking your time out this early, late, depending upon where you are on the globe, for spending time with us. Once again, for our listeners, if you enjoyed this episode and you want to get into the conversation, there will be a thread posted in coalition.agileuprising.com. And we also now have a Discord channel if you want to get into and do some real live time conversation and video around this. Please reach out and give us a shout. Once again, thank you, Yuta. Thank you, John. And until next time, this is the Agile Uprising Podcast, signing out.